It's a hard one to bet unless you build your whole army list around it, which you can do.
Spike scan initiated. I'm picking up a podcast arriving. Wait. Designation: Forge the Narrative.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. We are the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Evening, everybody.
Red Powell and Tanya Gates.
Hello. Hey, everybody.
What up, what up? We are officially, we're making, doing this recording in 2022. Last show, even though it came out in 2022, we recorded that right before the end of last year. New year, new us, new codexes. We got Adeptus Custodes to talk about this week.
Yeah, I guess Paul's made the call. We're going to try and break this up because it was just going to be, there is a lot to unpack in both these codexes. Because actually, it's interesting to think about in 8th edition, right? Because 8th edition, all the complexity came from the combos you got within your super faction. Like, how could adding Harlequins to your Nari, or you know, adding Marines to guard or whatnot? And now we just had that extra level of complexity added to every individual book, where you get your mono faction bonuses, and then a little bit on top, and a little bit of extra spice, and then the thing that makes them unique. And so I feel like if we were to try and do both books, we'd like half.
Oh! Don't make it sound like we're gonna miss things in this one too. We probably.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely right. I'm super excited for this book. I've been excited for a Custodes book for probably Custodes plays for like 2 years. You've been excited for having a new book, and yeah, this one is it's actually better than I thought it was going to be honest.
Yeah, this is making. So I painted some Custodes for a display a few years ago for the Adepticon team tournament. So it's making me looking at those few Custodes like, you know what? I can build this out.
This can become something.
Yeah, exactly. Look at like 4 or 5 models. Well, Tanya, I mean, as you play in Custodes like right now, like today, are you excited about what's coming?
No, not really. No, I'm just joking. Yeah, of course I am. Of course I am. Yeah. I just finished painting a Sisters of Silence Vigilator squad, and I've got 6, 7, I've got 8 models out on my desk right now that are in like some form of assembly line here. So, you know, that's probably like 2000 points right there, but, I'm really excited for this new codex and for a new challenge that it, puts in front of me.
Yeah. I really feel like the old codex was in an interesting spot. I had a lot of fears about this codex because I thought Custodes was a faction that was sitting on a little bit of a house of cards. Firstly and foremost, I felt like of all the codexes in the game, Custodes needed Forge World the most. Like they needed the Telamons, they needed the Galatus Dreadnoughts, the Venator.
To hang in the top echelons of events that we've been seeing.
To kind of feel relevant. And I feel like that's because their data sheets in the main book don't quite hold up. Like I think I've talked about it elsewhere, but for 35 points you get a Blade Guard now. For 35 points you get a Grotesque. And then how many points is a Custodial Guard?
As it stands right now, like 45.
And 45. This is still 45, by the way, in this new book.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. 40, for 10 more points, the same amount of wounds, the same armor save as the Blade Guard, the same invuln as the Blade Guard, unless you take sword and board, and the less attacks, to all intents and purposes. And it just felt wrong. It felt wrong. I felt like they didn't feel like Custodes anymore. They didn't feel like the super elite army that they did. And I feel like they showed their age. So I'm really keen to see some updated data sheets.
Let me caveat, what is it? 45 points for the base per model unit cost. 3 points for the Misericordia, 5 points for the Praesidium shield.
Cool. I mean, that sounds pretty accurate. Like, that sounds pretty similar to what it is now, right?
Yeah, I think it's the exact same. Yeah. Or maybe you didn't pay any points for the Misericordia. Or it was 4 points or something. It's comparable, very comparable.
Yeah, very comparable. And so I'm really happy with that. I think their points costs were about right. Their data sheets, they needed like another wound, another attack, something to jazz them up and make them stand out.
Yeah, well, there's some things in here that did get some nice upgrades, and we'll certainly talk about it. There's the katas, the martial katas that you pick. And this is the one. There's a little bit of complexity in this, and I think that we should talk about it. And then I don't want to overshadow the Sisters of Silence that are also in this that can be very much built as part of this force. And I think we'll see folks working them into their list. You have the ability to play them completely as their own detachment, which is also cool.
I almost feel like the biggest winners in this book is the Sisters of Silence, who went from a nigh on irrelevance in a lot of tense purposes. Like, you brought them to just fill out slots. And I feel like they're such a winner. Like, they're a legitimate portion of your army now. You're going to feel good about taking them.
They get some good rules, too. We'll talk about the Psychic Anathema as we get to that part in the show. And we're not going to cover every necessarily little nook and cranny of things, but I want to talk about some of the things that I think are, either reasons to jump in or things that maybe worked before that still work now, and then some extra little things you might be able to do or consider that you may not have considered before, like a shield captain on a jet bike again, Dunningle jet bike with 9 wounds.
Spicy.
And then there's some of the things like the stratagems are still here. Tanglefoot is still here, and I think it works basically the same way. You roll a d6 and subtract that from basically all forms of movement.
Yep, I'm so happy they kept that. Like, that was their spicy sauce, right? That a couple of these like game changer stratagems that essentially no one had the equivalent of in all of 8th edition. They had like these 3 or 4 strats that were just all their own. They had the charge, the come down and charge was 3 or 6 inches away rather than 9 inches from the teleport homer off the banner. They had the unleash the lions where an Alaris Terminator unit just got to split. And I hear they still got that, right?
Oh yeah, no, they definitely do. The Alaris Terminator, you had to split up. It's so if it's 3 or 4 models, it's 1 CP. If it's more than that, it's 2 CP for the unleash the lions. It allows you to break up a unit of multiple models into individual units.
And like, no one else has that. That's just a straight up Custodes only. And then the last one I think they had that was very unique to them was Stooping Dive, like declaring a charge in your opponent's charge phase. And then you fight before them. Yeah, I felt like if anyone was going to go, that one feels like the one that's the biggest. Like, it's, how do you use that without it being a gotcha, right? How do you leverage it without it being a gotcha? And so I felt like if anyone was going to go, it was probably going to be that one.
I think of the things that Custodes may have been doing with some regularity. Tanya, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the only real thing that is now been missing or replaced by something else.
The Stooping Dive?
Yes. That's not in the new codex.
Okay, so here's how I feel about Stooping Dive. I feel like it is amazing when you can get it done, but it was 3 CP. And I feel like, at least the way that I played, I'm a very defensive player, so I was using a lot of my CP early on to use a lot of defensive strats. So it was really hard to justify spending 3 CP on that unless you knew for a fact that you were going to make that charge and you knew for a fact that it was going to essentially like shift momentum or give you a crazy advantage. So it's not one that I used, but I know that a lot of people used it all the time. So I'm not particularly sad to see it go.
There we go. Fair.
I'm happy to hear that, actually, because yeah, I thought it would be lamented, like me, like, oh no, such a piece of our special sauce gone.
I think some people will definitely complain that it's gone, but it's
different. It was there, yeah. You could build something around it if you chose to take units in your army that let you enable that. But that is one bit of tactics and tech that is not the same in the new codex.
Well, hopefully the katas make up for it with all their super spicy stuff.
Katas are cool. Katas are going to be one of the. I think that's the learning curve going. The initial hurdle you have to get over. To get good at the army is going to be that, because there's a cadence, and I love it, by the way, that the cadence actually plays out as if they are performing this kata. Kata is a series of movements, and ritualistic or in a way maneuvers.
They're gonna tai chi their way across that battlefield
with giant pokey sticks.
Yes.
Is it tai chi or is it krav maga?
Tai Chi is the real slow one, right?
That is.
Yeah.
I imagined them like, doing Tai Chi because I thought it was funny, but never mind.
Whether they're moving slow or they're fast, they're very strong. And would take me out.
I'm finding these quite confusing because they feel like Necron protocols, but they're not quite, right?
So let me run down my layman's interpretation of them. So each martial kata has 2 stances, stance 1 and a stance 2. You pick three martial katas before the game starts. After both sides are deployed, but before you determine who will have first turn, you must select a primary, secondary, and tertiary martial kata from the list over here. You look at the list, you pick one, stance one, stance two. You have to, and your primary, secondary, and tertiary are very important because you have to advance through them. And then once you abandon a kata, you can't go back. So if, let's say, you were to pick Callistus and stance one, stance two, at the beginning of your turn, you can pick which of those stances, stance one, you enter. But if you go to stance two, and then go to another martial kata in round two, you can never go back and then revisit stance one from the Callistus.
So they do the moonwalk, but once you've completed the moonwalk, you can never moonwalk again.
That's right. Yeah, you get one shot. It's probably going to be electrifying. It is going to set the world on fire, and there will be many imitators. But that's done for you.
That's it. Eminem singing in the background. You got to lose yourself.
So here's the down and dirty. After I've just explained that, here's the down and dirty bullet points here. You cannot select a kata stance more than once. You must select a primary kata stance first. You cannot select a tertiary stance until you have selected the secondary stance. So that's very important. Also, that's why I said the primary, secondary, and tertiary really matters. And then once you select a stance of a different martial kata, you cannot select a stance of a previous martial kata. It does go on to give an example, but that's it. Once you start one, if you jump to another kata, then you can't go back to it. You have to progress through them, but you can't go back once you've jumped. So you could conceivably get into, you know, going into battle round four and have no stance to do without a stratagem or some other thing, you know.
Interesting.
So I think that's going to be the thing that people have to juggle at first, because you're right. I don't think it's quite the same as protocols. I don't think it's quite the same as canticles and that kind of, but they're not too dissimilar from each other.
And Red, you choose them before the game starts, right? It's like not part of list building.
It's not part of it. It's after both sides are deployed, but before you determine who will have first turn, you select your primary, secondary, and tertiary martial katas.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, back to, like Paul mentioned, I it's not dissimilar. It has some, and I'm okay with this aspect of taking mechanics and kind of playing it out over multiple armies. You know, it's not like every time an army comes out and a codex comes out, even if it's as vastly different in aesthetic from Necrons to Custodes, that the mechanic in this regard of this, you know, just like, you know, Tanya, I think it's an absolutely appropriate question. You know, is this during list building? Does it have to be set in stone? No, it doesn't. Okay, so you have a lot of flexibility in how you go through it. Paul, do you mind answering for me, how many are there to choose from?
Six.
And so that's not bad. I mean, and understanding that you're going to get three of them. And
each with two stances apiece. Yeah.
So. Right. And so a total of 12. And so you can sequence that to a certain degree. I think it's good flexibility. I think it's a good mechanic. I know that there's that finite aspect of it, and that it's not played out across every turn is probably going to be disparaged to certain extents. But at the same time, like, I mean, I think having finite aspects makes you value it more to certain degrees, right? And so you really have to understand when you're going to apply it and where you're going to play it out. And I think that that's perfect for a elite army. I'm interested to see it play out. I'm interested to see it used to varying degrees of effectiveness, especially given the various combos that we've started to see people talk about as the leaks have come through and the different community releases have been made. I mean, when we talked about it back beforehand, it definitely is something when we look at tactics and maneuvering and whatnot, the tempo is such a crucial piece to it. And how this plays into it, you know, you can talk about Tai Chi or Krav Maga. That's absolutely appropriate, in my opinion, given the tempo of it. And so if your tempo is off and you don't know how to play into it, you're definitely going to throw yourself out. And that's where Paul, you mentioned a learning curve. I think that people really need to play around with this to figure out that that tempo for this mechanic specifically.
To really assess the threat across the table too and find out what's the most appropriate thing. There's a little bit of forgiveness in the shield host fighting styles. Each fighting, all shield host units in a shield host attachment will gain a shield host fighting style, each of which includes two traits. The fighting style they gain depends on which shield host they're assigned to. There's and we're not going to go through all of them, but I'm just kind of prefacing this. Each fighting style also specifies a martial kata. Once per battle, when you select one of the kata stances to be active for your army, you can use this ability. If you do so, that kata's other stance also becomes active for your army. But that other kata stance does not count as being selected as the active kata stance, meaning you are not prevented from selecting that in subsequent command phase, provided you haven't already done so and are able to use the ability, even if you selected the other kata stance to be active in your previous command phase. So just a little bit of a cushion there, based on the preferred martial kata of whatever shield host you choose.
Yeah, so that feels very similar to the to what Necrons get, because that's, I mean, if you're Novok, you'll get a certain in Hungry Void protocol, you'll get both bonuses. So that's quite comparable. But it's interesting to know that I believe some of these cards are quite a bit more impactful on the game than the Necron ones. At least I believe from what I've seen, and not because I think the Necron ones are less powerful, just because I feel like you've got so few models as a Custodes player that every buff you're able to put and layer onto them, it just makes that unit better and better and better exponentially. Whereas if you take 20 warriors and give them +1 strength, it's not as impactful as like adding +1 attack onto the premium platforms, so to speak, especially if you can get similar stuff from elsewhere.
Well, let's look at this one, the Conserve. Stance 1, the unit can perform an action in a turn in which it advanced or fell back.
Yeah, perfect. And in your super
talk
elite
about
army,
impacting the game, that's
exactly points. That's what I mean. In a super elite army, you need to get units to do as many different roles as possible. They have to wear lots of different hats in a single game. That's a perfect example. And mind you, what I said before about buffs being more impactful on more elite stuff is counterintuitive to how we usually play the game. I'm more thinking about how 9th edition is being played at the moment rather than anything else. I'm sorry, that might be some meta stuff we don't really want to go into.
Oh, I mean, please explore it, especially if you think it's tied into this, because there is, like, when you're playing an elite army, it is, and you're a brick, you are, you know, pound for pound, probably the most durable thing in the game, but you could easily put yourself out of position to where you're not scoring the points, or you mismatch up against an opponent's unit.
So I'll give you an example. So picking the right turn, let's say you've got a super elite army, it doesn't have a lot of redundancy. You need to use these cards appropriately to pick the right turn in which the critical moment's going to happen. Like the turn you go for it, you invest, you try and win the game and change the tide. Because a lot of the time the game is won or lost, usually in turn 2 and turn 3. A lot of the time, games of 40k are won and lost. Usually, turn 5, I'd say I'll put it support as well, as a personality, as a commentator, as somebody who watches so many games, I find that turn 5, turn 4, I usually have a good idea who's going to win, and turn 5, I know who's going to win. Before turn 5 occurs, 90% of the time, it's pretty clear who's going to win and who's going to lose. And so, for an army like Custodes that doesn't have that redundancy, the turns in which you choose to enable your efficiencies and go to that extra level are so ultra important. So extremely important in the current game of 9th edition, and not missing when you swing. When you go for it, every bit of redundancy, every bit of efficiency matters, not redundancy rather. And so yeah, I think this is really good. I think this is and if I was going to say a big bold statement, Carters are so much better for Custodes than Protocols are for Necrons.
Oh, nice. There's a lot of words around the kata stuff in here. And I think if you're just getting into the faction, don't get lost in the technicalities of the rules writing, the bullet points. You know, it's a little bit more intuitive than it looks on the page, I think.
Yeah, because when it was first explained in the Warhammer community, I read it, I'm like, I'm not sure I quite understand this. And I kind of didn't revisit it. I'm just waiting for the book to come out to kind of just sit with it.
Yeah, it's one of those, it's just when you start and try to line it up like what you want, like you plan it like you're planning your turns to one or two turns in advance, which you probably should be doing anyway, and then know that each piece is worth more than, I was going to say it's weight in gold, but I might be too on the nose.
It's good.
So that's it. Plan it out like you would be doing. You're thinking about where you. We always talk about where you want to move one or two turns in advance. You know, not necessarily where you're going right now, but where you're going to end up, and I think that's where the katas have to come into play too. And then, you know, what we've seen, especially as this edition has matured and codexes have matured, and what I mean by they've, you know, people have played reps, it's been around a while, people are starting to, you know, really look for advantages and incremental little bit of things they can ring out. We've seen people take combinations of things that give them those incremental advantages that end up to being, you know, big landslides in certain situations. And I think we may see that with the various shield hosts and their ability to double up on one or two katas.
Yeah, and the shield hosts, so the shield hosts got added in Psychic Awakening, really adding that extra level onto the 8th edition Custodes book. And then, of course, there was Imperial Armor that gave them another shot in the arm with, you know, Telamons just being, like, nigh unkillable. Like, the most unkillable tank, mechanized platform.
Good, it looks like
in
it.
The game. Like,
it looks like it should be.
As long as you've, but it's funny, yeah, because as long as you've got CP, they're harder to kill than a knight. Like, hands down, harder to kill. That's right, Tanya, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I can't say in the new book, but in the old book, yeah, if you had the CP, like, you could juice them up real good.
I'm a fan.
So that's something, I think, to look at. And, you know, beyond just the color scheme of the cool shield host, and each shield hoster, it's set up like we come to expect. Each shield host has, you know, some traits apply to it. Got a warlord trait, and then a relic, and then a special stratagem that they can use. So a lot of flexibility there. I think there's durability. This book is steeped in durability and ways to make things durable. There's some that are even more durable than others. And I think we'll see some really tanky things emerge as maybe some of the initial go that people make.
Because that was a worry I had. Because like knights, in 9th edition, Custodes have, outside the fact that they had one of the last vestibules.
I think that's a balcony. I think that's a small balcony.
So. They were one of the last locations where you could get a density of 3+ invulnerable saves. Like, that literally was pretty much the last time you could get a squad that had just had a standing 3+ on as it had on the starter sheet. And that carried them from a long time. But outside that, they actually didn't feel durable. Like, they didn't feel that outside them and the Telamon. Venatari, like, very easy to kill by 9th edition standards. Regular Shield Guard, very easy to kill. Alaris, quite easy to kill. Virtus Praetors, extremely easy to kill, especially with the flat 3+ D3 damage weapons. So you're min 4, so killing a bike every time. I was really hopeful a lot of these things feel like a Custode again in this book.
Nice. So there's the Aquilan Shield, which is one of the shield hosts, and, you know, we're going to kind of be picky and choosy in here, maybe as the next episode, and we'll talk about others, or certainly if anybody wants to know more about any of these, let us know. We're happy to cover them, kind of stuff. But it has a 1 CP called the Shield of Honor. Use this stratagem in your opponent's shooting phase. When an enemy unit is selected to shoot, select one Imperium Infantry character unit from your army until the end of that phase, while the unit from your army is within 6 inches of a friendly Aquilan Shield core unit. Enemy units cannot target that Imperium Infantry character unit with ranged weapons. So, you know, how many times we've seen that play out to be really good for characters.
That's pretty cool.
This one goes real far. So it has a warlord trait, Rever Champion. Each time an attack is allocated to this warlord, have the damage characteristic of that attack rounding up.
Ooh, that's big. Yeah. Because I don't know if you guys missed it at the start, but biker captains, 9 wounds.
And then there's the relic, the Praesidius. So it's a Quillen shield model equipped with this Praesidium shield only. Each time an attack is made against the bearer, subtract 1 from that attack's wound roll.
Nice.
So have fun with these, that shield captain. He will be around a long time.
Yes.
Chopping and stabbing.
That's cool.
Before we get too far or a break to go into the next segment, I would like to talk about the Anathema Psychana. This is the Sisters of Silence and their special rule and, you know, essentially, you know, what they get and why it's impactful. So before we get in there is that when you're heavy, if you have the Emperor's Legion, you cannot include more Anathema Psychana troops units than you do the Adeptus Custodes troops in each unit of Adeptus Custodes detachments from your army. You cannot include any more Anathema Psychana HQ units than you do in your Adeptus Custodes HQ units in each Adeptus Custodes detachment. You cannot select an Anathema Psychana model as your warlord. So that's when you're pulling the Emperor's Legion. You can pick an Anathema Psychana detachment only, and in which case they will get ejector secured. So that's always nice.
Mm-hmm.
It comes up You know, so you think it never comes up until it like wins you a couple of games and you're like, wow, this objective secured is really good. Always perk up when you see it.
Yeah. And I just love them being a viable choice.
I like it too. They're cool models, and they have been kind of sidelined, but they have the rule Daughters of the Abyss.
Yep.
Which is, this unit cannot be targeted or affected by psychic powers. Each time a psychic test is taken for a unit, subtract one from the total for each unit with this ability within 18 inches of that unit to a maximum of -3.
Not bad.
Yikes.
One more bullet point. Bad. Each time an attack made by a model in this unit targets an enemy psyker or demon unit within 6 inches of it, add one to that attack's wound roll.
Nice.
So was that shooting as well?
Yeah, each time an attack made
any
by this
attack.
Model.
Yeah.
Oh,
nice.
So the flamers are just like roast toasting, just like Grey Knights. Just
You got to get close. You got to make sure. Get them all. burnt out of there. But interesting thing is that they can like the Witch Seekers with the flamers, they get a pregame move, and they get a pregame 6-inch move. Their actual movement characteristic is 7. But their Seeker Cadre rule allows them to move up to 6 inches, and that includes any transport that they're in.
That's cool. Yes. So they got the same treatment as like Dominions did for Sisters players. That's cool. Yeah. So you could chuck 10 of them in a Rhino, scout it out. Like, you think about like Pink Horrors.
See you later.
The bad time.
Or even the Tyranid Menace that we know exists right now.
Yeah, that's like, fair.
Most of those units outside of the smallest bugs are Psykers.
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot. Just about all their characters, man.
Yep. And so I think it's interesting they've capped it to a maximum of -3. And I think that, so let me, I can't look at a codex without looking, trying to figure out like what's value is, and then what might be some cool things you could just kind of fit into your list in a way. The Knight Centura, that's the Sister of Silence HQ unit, the non-named HQ unit, is 50 points.
That's cool. So, and you can take one of those if you take a Custodes HQ, yeah?
Yeah. So, I mean, yes, you can. You can't have any more of them than you have Custodes HQs.
Oh, that's a huge quality of life improvement. So now you don't have to take two Custodes HQs to fill out a battalion. You can take your one, whichever, maybe your Trajan or your biker captain or your foot captain, whatever you like. And you take, that's like 100 point saving just right there for filling out a battalion. That's big. That's a big deal.
Yeah. I do like that it exists. I think that's a very relevant ability now more than ever. And sometimes those -1s are going to stack up, and sometimes being immune to something immune to something is never bad.
No, never bad. Yeah, I'm a huge fan. Yeah, I really look forward to seeing Talons of the Emperor on the battlefield. Only thing I wish they'd give us rules for the black ship. I wish. It's such a gorgeous model. I love it so much. It's just, the aesthetic is perfection.
Do you mean like as a faction or like an actual ship?
I want that, the black ship from Forge World that they have in Horus Heresy.
The Flash Gordon looking thing, right?
Yeah, I want those rules in 40K. I want to be able to take that instead of a Rhino if I want.
Yeah, I love that.
That would be a beautiful world.
Yep, agree on all counts. I don't know how big it is though. I don't know if I've seen one in real life.
Yeah, I've seen one and it's bigger than you think.
Okay.
Yeah, they're pretty big. I was going to say, I'm not sure how they would play into it.
It's not about the same size as a drill, Adam. I think. Thank you, Brad.
There's a bunch. So there are 4 pages of stratagems.
Nice. That's a good amount. Because, I mean, strats have been the thing that makes Custodes. They have that's their shtick.
Yeah. There's a really cool one too. The Shoulder of the Mantle. Use a stratagem when your warlord is destroyed. Select another Adeptus Custodes character. It becomes the warlord, and anything that would have triggered like with the death of a warlord doesn't.
So in the old book, in the way that it was written, you could essentially, it said that you would give them a warlord trait like immediately. Does it still say that?
It does. Yeah. If the model does not have a warlord trait, it gains a warlord trait of that destroyed warlord.
So you pass.
Oh, so it is different. It's different. Okay. And only if he doesn't have one already.
Yes.
Okay. So that's different. Okay.
Oh, stack up like 4 or 5 warlords. That would get. Does he throw him his relics too? Like when he goes down, no matter where he is in the battlefield, he's like, avenge me.
Take my bike.
Oh, that would be. That would be good. They also have the ability to deny psychic powers. I mean, this, yep, on a four
that,
up.
That, yeah, that was like a go-to strategy for me. Mm-hmm. It was just, especially going into like Thousand Suns and stuff, like you'd be using that every turn.
Yeah, and this is from the Anathema psychic infantry, the psychic infantry.
So,
four plus psychic powers denied.
I have a 9th edition design feature that is becoming a little bit of a trope of mine that I like to bring up. So, in 8th edition, we all complained about D3 damage weapons. All of us. You did, I did, we all did. Why is D3 damage a weapon? Why is, you know, it's so frustrating, D3 damage. The difference between rolling a 1 or a 2 and rolling a 5 or a 6.
Because we roll a lot of 1s. That's why we complain.
It's straight. Well, you roll a handful, and every time you see a 1, you're just like, why? Why is that there? And so, confirm something for me, because this my gut feeling was that all the D3 damage weapons are just going to become 2 damage weapons. And nobody had more D3 damage weapons than Custodes, like percentage of their book wise.
Yep.
It was literally every combat weapon. Is that still the case, or have they gone to 2 damage?
So they are 2 damage. So the Sentinel Blade and the Guardian Spear are 2 damage.
Yeah, and the Castellan Axe and the Warden Axe is 2 damage as well.
The Castellan Axe, 2 damage.
Yep. And what is the spear? What is the Interceptor Lance?
The Interceptor Lance, please stand by.
So that is what it's called, right?
The Interceptor Lance, damage 2, yeah.
Okay, so they're all damage 2. Like, literally any profile outside Forge World, for melee, 2 damage.
Speeds up the game a little bit too, though, so...
I find that... okay, here's the issue, guys. Here's the issue, guys. The whole competitive meta of the game now, literally 3/4 of the lists are built around having -1 damage.
Yeah.
Like 3/4 of them. You have a very good Tyranids list called Crusher Stampede. It was an army of renown, -1 damage. The best list in the game, which is a Drakari list that leverages -1 damage almost army wide. And then you also have Orcs who have it in Ramshackle almost army wide if they want it to be. And this is my I remember I said this. I said, we all complained about heavy bolters didn't do anything and too much D3 damage weapons. And then G Dub made all the D3s and heavy bolters 2 damage and then put -1 damage on everything and laughed and laughed and laughed at us for complaining about the D3 damages. And then we're all like, give us back the D3 damage, please. Because it's just better to have a chance to get 2 damage.
To get through there. Look, just make up for it in all your attacks and your katas.
Yeah, that was what I was about to say. If you can get enough attacks, it's okay. But that's probably my only gripe in the design of this book so far. Everything else looks magnificent.
I think you're going to get enough attacks, and I think you're going to be able to buff up units. I don't think there's going to be any shortage of things to pass around and heroic opportunities to get through that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I hear there's a stratagem to just make something heroic and divine. Like any one of your units, just bang 1 CP, you get to heroic and divine. And if you're already heroic and divine, you're heroic and divine 6 inches.
That is true. That's exactly true.
Amazing stratagem. Huge fan.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think any of those out of phase stuff, you have to perk up and like, oh, when can I do this? And then be prepared to do it, and then make sure you. And there is a risk of like burning a lot of CP. I should say that's never a risk, by the way. That's how I like to play this game.
That's why I was a big fan as soon as hearing that you're going to save a bunch of points on a battalion, because I always felt like Custodes wanted to have a battalion, but always ended up having a patrol instead, which just limited a lot of your options. Like, you can only have 2 of all the elites and heavy supports and fast attacks. And so as soon as they can build a legitimate battalion, oh, that's going to feel really good, guys.
So then there's some unit upgrades, you know, the captain commanders, things you can do to mm-hmm. upgrade them that could also go for, again, mastering stances. There's things that are built around the things to make, you can really spend a lot of time trying to figure out what is important to you, what you enjoy most about the aspects of the army, and then play it that way and find things that accentuate that for you.
Nice. Yeah. It feels like an exciting book.
I'm digging. That's not even just like radio talk. It's making me like, I already have Valerian and Aaliyah. Like, of course, I'm halfway, like 3/4 of the way to this army.
Yep.
Plus, I just painted all those Terminators. I'm like, man, I can sit down and pay 30 Terminators in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. It's everything you'd ever need.
Honestly, like, I'm not even painting my Custodes gold, and I find the models are very forgiving. I have never painted an army faster than what I, well, I've never had a paint scheme that I can paint a single model faster than what I'm doing now.
Nice. One thing to talk about before we hit the break is that the Vexillus, the Vexilla Defensor, has changed. And I think it's actually better, but I'll let y'all decide. And here we go. So the bearer has the following aura ability. While a friendly shield host core or shield host character unit is within 6 inches of this model and has the benefits of light cover.
Mm. So the Defensor used to be the one that gave...
five up invul to every Imperium.
Yeah, Imperium stuff. Because I used to take it in my with my Guardsmen in 8th edition. Mm-hmm. So that's really big. So tell me something about the Storm Shields. The pseudo Storm Shield. Do they give plus one save?
They just get the invulnerable save. Yeah, it's just
they don't give you plus one armor. As well,
actually, let me tell you that for sure. Yeah, add one of the armor saving throws for the bearer. Yes, and then the Aegis the Emperor gives them the invulnerable save. Walking across the table, given everything, this amazing defensive buff that you're already taking in your army, save just basically like, yo, come at me and the invulnerable, and then the ability to stack it. The Vexillus Praetor is also a character, mm-hmm. So it's going to be real difficult to dig them out.
Yeah, like so just walking at your opponent with a zero plus save on your shield guard, that feels phenomenal.
Yeah, with the light cover kind of, this is going to be what, so it's a big change. It's maybe a change of how you were playing it before, but I actually think this is better for the Custodes, which is what you're playing this army for.
Well, yeah, because they became a maybe Tanya or Red will back me up on this. They feel like they became a list of an army, almost like a gimmick army, where you just had all these little you had a pretty generic looking force, and then you had just these little spicy things you could do every now and then. But apart from that, all your CP and all your resources was just trying to make the durable army more durable because you were so elite, you needed to. But then 9th edition just felt so killy that I really felt like they needed more wounds, they needed more defensive buffs to make them feel imposing again. And this is certainly a step in the right direction.
Well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit more about the Custodes. Then we're going to talk a little bit about tanks and a particular tank weapon that has everyone just shaking in their boots. See you in a minute.
Nice.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
We are back. So now, look, in every one of these codexes, there are some secondaries that are specific to the faction itself, and this is no different. The Custodes have three secondaries, one in No Mercy, No Respite, one in Purge the Enemy, and then one in Battlefield Supremacy. The No Mercy, No Respite is Might of Terra. Score 4 victory points at the end of the battle round if one or more enemy units were destroyed this battle round, and no Adeptus Custodes or Anathema Psychana units from your army were destroyed this battle round.
Ooh, that is...
It's tough.
I mean, it's tough. You can imagine...
No, no.
Yeah, so the issue is there. That one would make you feel like you don't want to take any Sisters of Silence, because you just want to take, like, above average sized custodial units. So everything's just super hard to kill. But then, like, you...
There's so much variance there, man. Like, you just have... Yeah. You have just one run of bad rolling, and you put yourself out of the game.
I feel like that's a hard one to bet unless you build your whole army list around it, which you can do.
Yeah. So, next one is Battlefield Supremacy. This is score 3 victory points at the end of the battle round if you control more objective markers that are not within either player's deployment zone than your opponent does.
I don't mind that one, actually.
Yeah, you're trying to do that anyway, right?
Yeah, you are, exactly. It's already trying to do it. Essentially, like, it's another stranglehold.
Yeah, I think that's not too bad. I actually like that, because so what the reason that I'm saying that, and we kind of just mentioned it, is that you're going to be probably maneuvering to do that anyway.
Mm. So does that one compete with Stranglehold? Do you guys
Battlefield Supremacy? So yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
The next one is Purge the Enemy. This is Auric Mortalis. This one, it's got a little bit of a twist. You gotta wait. Let me get to the end of this one. So, if you select this objective, then before the battle, you must select one unit from your opponent's army that has the Primarch or Supreme Commander keyword to be marked for death. If no units exist, select one unit from your opponent's army with the highest point value to be marked for death. Aircraft units are ignored when selecting a unit to be marked for death. So you never have to pick the Manta. Everything's cool. At the end of the battle, calculate how many victory points to a minimum of 0 you score for this objective as follows. 5 victory points if the unit you selected to be marked for death was destroyed. 5 victory points if the unit you selected to be marked for death was destroyed as a result of a melee attack made by an Adeptus Custodes or an Anthema Psychana unit from your army. 5 victory points if both of the above are true and the unit you selected to be marked for death was destroyed more than 6 inches away from your deployment zone. And then here's the twist. -2 victory points for each unit from your army that the unit you selected to be marked for death destroyed.
Oh no.
Oh.
Oh
no.
Oh, I was like, yeah. This was, so there are other armies that have an equivalent of this, but usually it's your opponent's warlord or your opponent picks a character. I really like that this one said pick their most expensive unit, and so it could be like, you know, like a Stellan or something.
Non aircraft too, so you know that does matter. You know, again, I was talking about that 400 point.
Yeah, and so it's or whatever. Yeah, their most expensive unit. So that is cool because it could be like their biggest unit that you have to handle, you have to deal with anyway. But if it's their biggest unit and it's their best unit, technically there's no big and best unit in the game that doesn't get some heavy lifting done in 9th edition. Like you're talking a full Terminator squad or like, you know, 3 Talos or something crazy. Like I said, like a Castellan. And you just can't pick this. Just like, no.
This is gritty though. I mean, think about calling your shot. Like I'm going to take this objective. I'm going to run at you to make sure that this engagement happens outside of my deployment zone. Not even out of my deployment zone, but like deep out of my deployment zone. Because I don't want you consolidating around the corner of my unit, my already small unit, and then scooping me out of 5 points. I got to get over there, be incredibly aggressive, and kill you before you remove a single unit of mine.
That's fearsome. That's a fearsome prospect to think you're just going to have that confidence. I love it.
Oh, think about this. So a big, like, what's the max unit of Alaris Terminators you can have?
It used to be 9.
I'm going to go and check.
Unless it's changed.
I don't believe that it's changed, but let me just check right now just so we can. So take the biggest unit of Alaris Terminators. Yeah, 6. Alaris Custodians, 6. Mm-hmm. Run them out there, do all the killing, and then break them up into the Unleash the Lions.
Oh, that's cool. That is real cool. I love that unit as well. They're one of my favorite models in all the 40K.
That the way the shoulder pads and the plume, and that is gorgeous. I don't know if you're taking that secondary though, but yeah,
I think the pseudo stranglehold is the better one because that one, the pseudo stranglehold, is a stranglehold that means you don't need to sit in your deployment zone. You can just push your whole army at them and not have to worry about you having to have stuff in your backfield to level out your home objectives. You this can just be like, bam, we're going for it.
Strikes me as way more like kitchen table Warhammer, where your buddy brought over Magnus. You're like,
Vendetta.
Let's do it.
Vendetta Warhammer.
I bet you that I'm going to take you out. Like, nope, you're not, because I'm super beef.
One question I have for you. So one of the greatest things about, and one of the beautiful pieces of foresight that G-Dub had when they were designing the original Custodes book, was that just about everything had OBSEC. Can you tell me if that's still the case?
I'll tell you what it says.
I'm actually like, while I'm waiting for this, my heart is like, it's like in my throat a little bit. I'm like, please give me some good news.
This book is full of good stuff. Adeptus Custodes. Adeptus Custodes detachment gained the Emperor's Legion host of heroes and watchers of the throne ability. Adeptus Custodes units in the Adeptus Custodes detachments gained the shield host fighting style ability. Adeptus Custodes infantry units and Anathema Psychonic troops troop units in Adeptus Custodes detachments gained the objective secure ability. This is troops.
Lame.
Nice. What? You said lame. I said nice.
Each Adeptus Custodes model counts as one additional model when determining control of objective markers. This is cumulative any other rules that makes them count as additional models.
I love it. That's the one. That's what they needed. That's the kicker. Because it used to be like people usually have like units of 3 Custodes guard to sit back and guard their objectives, which is a very expensive 3 models to sit back in an objective. And then somebody just walked over with 5 intercessors and take it off you. Well, now those 3 Custodes guard count as 6 models. So you got to kill one to hold it with 5 intercessors. I love it.
Yeah. There's stuff you can do with the dreadnoughts, you know, stratagems, you can key off them. This is, like I said, with 4 pages of stratagems, there's a lot to do. There's lots of combos. I think that this is an army that you can get into and there's, even though you're not playing with a high model count army, there's a lot of depth and invariance and differences you could play. Every game could be a little bit different for you.
Having four pages of stratagems really does excite me, because it's like you said, like I went from playing guard where you had like, you know, maybe four or five stratagems depending on how you built your list that you would use. And then I went over to Custodes, and even just like the main rule book, I was like, I could see myself actually using these. Right.
And do you know what's disappointing about the guard one? You've actually got like 9 pages of stratagems to pick from, and you only use 4. Because you've got all the Militarum Tempestus ones, you've all got the Cadian Supplement ones, you've got the Psychic Awakening ones, you've got the actual rulebook ones. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. So yeah, having 4 pages of stratagems makes me very, very happy. I can't wait to dig in and start studying.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. And I can't wait to see your models, too. People check you out on Instagram if they have not already, because you got some gorgeous stuff.
Well, thank you. I'm having a lot of fun with them.
I know this is a little bit, typically when we do these kind of dives into the codexes, the shows get a little bit longer. So thanks for hanging with us. But look, there's been another bit of very exciting news that I don't know if we've properly addressed yet. And that is rail cannons.
Oh, my gosh.
Take it away.
And we know we have a tank enthusiast on the show.
I've been saving on this one. Like, I've been reserving myself just because I knew I was going to lose it over this. Because this isn't just about railguns. It's not about Tau, okay? For everybody out there, it's not just about Tau. It's about, we are like, this is it. Like, we're stepping into this whole thing of... I mean, it was such an amazing thing to see, just because no invuln save, strength 14. What's the damage at? Like
D3 plus 3, and then D3 plus 6, and then -3, 3 mortal wounds.
And yeah, an additional 3 mortal wounds. Like, don't get me wrong. When it comes down to it, tanks are intrinsically not, like, if tanks are killing tanks, then the fight's already gone wrong, right? You know, Adam, you wanted the black ships from Forge World. Mm-hmm. I want Exterminatus. I don't want to have to fight you on the ground. I just want to blow your planet up and move on. Right? And when you bring in a railgun like this, we're getting there. We're pushing that limit of technology of where we're, like, we're really at, where it's...
I mean,
okay, you get no shield, you get no nothing.
I love it that Red, yeah, you're basically speechless in awe of this stuff.
As a mechanic, it's perfect. I mean, I really do. Like, this is the kind of stuff, like, when you talk about shock and awe, and you're like, man, why, you know, okay, like, tanks are cool until, you know, a missile takes it out. Yeah, well, that telling you, when something can reach out and touch you at, you know, several kilometers away, that kind of deal, this railgun comes pretty close to sinking that feeling in. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty amazing.
So I love and am concerned about this. First and foremost, since 8th edition and what I like to call the modern era of the game, since, you know, the game has kind of stepped up. 7th edition was a dark time. It ended. Modern era of the game from 8th edition onwards, none of the anti-tank weapons have been able to kill a tank. Just none. Melter gun, impossible for it to kill a tank. Got 10 wounds. Dreadnought's got 8, you know? Lehman Russ Vanquisher, literally anti-tank gun, impossible to kill a tank. The railgun was the biggest issue, was the biggest one here. It's literally, the concept of the railgun was it was the one shot kill, and yet it did D6 damage, therefore cannot kill a tank. And so finally, these things feel like they're tank killers. They've been brought up to the level of the killiness of the stat lines of other ninth edition stat lines. The thing that concerns me
brought up, this has gone,
that's about, I was about
beyond
to say, it's not only brought up, it represents a new paradigm in these kind of things. So you think about a lot of other weapons that should have this profile. I just spoke about one. Fire prisms should be one of their profiles. Vanquishers, this should be one of their profiles. Anything that has Tank Hunter in their name from Forge World, this should be one of their profiles, if not their only profile. But what the issue is here is when you start getting to some of the outliers that have this kind of weapon attached to them. I think I'm talking exclusively about things like the Shadow Sword. So the Shadow Sword all of a sudden has to have something better than this to represent that. And then we're talking about, we have to get to new levels of extreme. The harpoon, guys, the harpoon on the Valiant doesn't look so good right now, you know? It needs to be, the harpoon needs to be better than this gun to now
good.
Keep its place. It's still pretty good, but it's not as good as this.
I mean, if you get in range of a harpoon, it's basically your fault.
But comparably, it's not as good as this. This will shoot you from the other side of the table. The harpoon has to be literally in charge range to do the damage. And so the harpoon needs to get better. The shadow sword needs to get better. The bane blade needs to get better. And so what this represents to me is the need for another level of killiness on top of
that's what I'm talking about.
Already killy game.
This escalation.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Technology is inherent.
Yes.
Like it is. It's only, it can,
it's a new art, new era.
Unless you redact it, right? Well, I mean, we're talking about the invention of interchangeable parts and everybody suddenly having a rifle. Everyone's got to have a tank killer now. It's got to happen.
Exactly right. That the arms race is on. And I personally love the fact that the Hammerhead and hopefully these other anti-tank, premium anti-tank weapons feel this good again. Because I looked at that stat line and I'm like, you're just going to feel good about having it. You know, you're just going to be like, I'm happy that I have a Hammerhead now with an actual railgun, which is what I was in my mind was always the gun that went on the Hammerhead. And yet you only saw the ion cannon for the last 4 years. And so very happy. And concerned about where this road may lead us.
Question. Aren't people just going to kill the Hammerhead first?
I'm not alarmed by the fact that it exists, by the way. I shouldn't say, because it's not deadly, is that there's a lot of unknowns, such as the durability of the profile that it's on, terrain, you know, how many points it cost, you know, there's all kind of stuff that's...
Plus, there's just so much anti-tank out there. It's probably it's probably going to have the same problems that Imperial Guard tanks have, right?
Yeah, spot on.
So I would be really shocked to see a lot of this enter into the meta, to be honest.
You think it's one of those that we're going to invent it and then it will never come to pass because we've already also invented the way to get around it?
Yeah.
I mean, if this entered the meta as it sits right here, right now, it would be good. It would be good. There are a lot of good targets in the best list in the game for this profile to go into. But you're also absolutely right, Tanya. There's because everyone is worried about those profiles, everyone has a lot of ways to kill this thing as well. I'm really excited right now. I think it's cool. I think it's a great thing. And I'm happy for Tau players to have something to get excited about.
That was the coolest thing. That was to me, that was really cool to see all the Tau players be like, you know what? Thank you.
Well, it feels very similar to what G-Dub did for Tau players with what G-Dub did for NID players with the Crusher Stampede. They went out of their way to make something that you haven't played with in at least 4 years for the railgun. Be excited about it. And I think that's the best thing that happened here.
Yeah, I mean, we look at the, you know, what is represented in tournaments quite often, and then seeing Tau kind of consistently on the lower side of that, and that's because people have kind of moved away from Tau, and you haven't seen a lot of people talking about it. And
yeah.
This was, you know, electrifying to Tau players and to folks that did not want to be shot by a rail. There's a lot of people that have now realized they do not want to be shot by rail cannons.
Well, I think about people taking all those Volkite Contemptor Dreads and just that is the ultimate one-shot, one-shield, one-kill target for that. Yeah, just wow. The day that Codex comes out, those dudes may just hit the shelf.
But that's what I like about it so much, though, is this aspect of it that it's Tanya, you know, you bring up a great point in that, isn't there just going to be something else? Well, yeah, there's eradicators, there's all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But, just the fact that it could exist or it could happen just starts to deter people from doing certain things.
Yeah, I do like that. If it comes into vogue, it'll be a meta warping aspect. And what I think that will happen from that, it will force us to come back into a more MSU, more spread out or horde esque style.
Well, we talk about terrain. Thing has the ability to jump over terrain. You know, at least the platform that it's on has the ability to kind of jump over terrain. And we know there's going to be rules that. I mean, we can assume there's going to be rules to help it shoot. So I think that in the right circumstances, this is going to be incredibly deadly. And I don't want to say it's necessarily go first dependent, but there'll be people that prep for it. It'll change things. The fact that it exists will change things.
If this was in the meta right now, I would take only one of them, and I'd barely use it, because the best thing it can do for me is sit behind terrain and scare the crap out of my opponent. As if like, when am I going to use it? Do you want to use your bits that's just going to get one shot by this? But, you know, I could just have it sit here and just shoot SMS, or I could use it and hit Nucha, or I could just sit here, and yeah, it'll just be fun.
Let's ignore math for a moment and be completely reactionary.
Well, see, that's the thing, yeah? If I bring it out, and only hits on a 3 or a 4, you know, please no, not a 4, and only hits on a 3, and my opponent sees that he can just shoot and not do anything, they won't be afraid of it anymore. But as long as they have the fear in the back of their mind, I can work with that.
Well, we've been seeing knights creep into the tournament scene.
Yeah, absolutely. Knights have got such an injection. Possibly the biggest winner from the balanced data slate that came out was knights getting OBSEC, essentially, given if you're mono knights, their mono faction bonus now, to all intents and purposes, is being OBSEC. And yeah, it's a huge deal. And this is a really nice little balancer on top of that. And naturally, this thing can't one-shot a knight. Two of them, you, like, realistically can't one-shot.
Rule of three. Right? I mean.
But yeah, three of them, just bang, 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 dead. It gets past the Ion Shield invuln. You don't get a save. Pretty awesome.
We got to be playing with Warhounds.
Yeah, step it up to Warhounds. Can't kill a Warhound.
Is that the escalation that Red was talking about? How many points is a Warhound? Is it 2,000?
It is, I believe. I've seen lists of just Warhound.
I have not seen that. But it has void shields, and the thing does not get around void shields.
That's true. It's 6+D3 with 3 mortal wounds on top, right?
I think it's D3+6. I mean, look, we don't have to guess.
Yeah, 6+D3. So max 9+3. So max 12 with the 3 mortal wounds. So two of them can't kill a Castellan, but two of them can kill a regular Questorus knight.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just like triple Valiant, baby. Let's go.
Then you gotta see if those harpoons can do something.
One of these harpoons gets to shoot.
You might be able to get up there and take out one hammerhead.
Yeah.
See, this is the part that I think is fun. Is that it is electrifying, literally electrifying. It's got people talking, and that's cool. And we'll see how it all plays out.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. Nice. I mean, because it could just be BS4+, and then it's just not an exciting prospect. Or it could hit on 2s re-rolling, and we're all like, wow, this thing's amazing. But then if it hits on 2s re-rolling, it could be like 200 points, and we're the same back to the same issue.
Yeah, look, that's our show for this week. I know we packed in a lot of stuff, and next week we'll be talking more about Custodes. Let us know if there's anything you're curious about, or let us know if you are starting an army. What are you building?
New army, guys. And we're going to crack into GSCs, right? Yeah?
Yes, absolutely. And Genesis Occult is going to be one of those to where, like, say, blips, still a thing? Codex comes with some blips if you didn't get them from the last set.
Amazing. I was just going to say, I'm really happy they've still got that. It feels like an awkward thing to learn for a new player or to account for it as an opponent, but I want that to be their core mechanic because it's so cool.
I think that we're kind of at the point where when it came out, when it originally came out, and if they were being played in more regularity, then... Or, you know, again, with the world being what it was, if we were getting people getting more games, then it would have already gotten past its, I feel bad, it's a strong word, but like kind of fun, spongy mechanic.
Feel. Exactly right. I mean, well, so it was one of the... It wasn't one of the last 8th edition books, but it was towards the end. It was like past the midway point of 8th edition when GSC came out, right? And they came with a whole new range, so it had some hobby lag on it. And then it got less than a year's probably run before it got COVID-ed, right? Yeah. And then it's just been sporadic use since then. So yeah, there might genuinely be some players who've had extremely limited exposure to the book.
Yeah, so I think that once people, you know, again, it's part of, it is, it's their shtick. They are supposed to be just creeping in the shadows, lurking behind every corner, and you know that's how they fight, and that's how the mechanics are come out. And, you know, it's going to be fun to talk about, I think, and then crack the code on what the optimal build is, because there's a lot of units, a lot of weapon options in that book, and well, we're going to tell you about them, and hopefully get some faction experts on and start our run of during the first part of this year. We're going to be talking with faction experts, people that have been like just hardcore devoted to factions, figuring out ways to win even when times were lean for them, and we'll talk to them when, you know, the codexes come out as well, and also hopefully maybe and just kind of pick their brain about ways that they've tackled different challenges and hurdles in their 4K journey. It's gonna be a great year.
Can't wait.
We'll see you next week.
See ya.
Prospect scan is clear. I think they're gone. For now.